British Prime Minister Theresa May is set to visit President Donald Trump. She will be the first foreign leader to meet the president since his inauguration. An obvious topic of conversation will be Britain's looming departure from the European Union. Last June, Britons voted to leave the EU. In a coincidence, then-candidate Donald Trump arrived in Scotland the very next day to visit one of his golf properties. He hailed the Brexit vote and likened it to what he was seeking to accomplish in the United States.
I really do see a parallel between what's happening in the United States and what's happening here. People want to see borders. They don't necessarily want people pouring into their country that they don't know who they are and where they come from. They have no idea. And I think, you know, it not only did it win, but it won by a much bigger margin than people thought it would happen.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And I'm Robert McMahon, Managing Editor of CFR.org.
You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the foreign policy challenges facing President Donald Trump. Each week, we look at an issue topping his foreign policy inbox, discuss what he has said he will do, and assess what choices he might make. This week, we're talking about Brexit. How will President Trump handle that issue?
And with us this week to help examine that is Sebastian Malaby. Sebastian is CFR's Senior Fellow for International Economics. He's an expert on globalization, international finance, and monetary policy, and he's the author of the new book, The Man Who Knew, The Life and Times of Alan Greenspan. He's also a contributing columnist for The Washington Post. Sebastian, thanks for being here.
Great to be with you.
Sebastian, many questions remain about how the UK will formally split from the EU, and I guess that's been further complicated by the UK Supreme Court's decision that dealt with Parliament's role, among other things. So could you give us a sense of the state of play of the Brexit process right now?
Sure. So it's been 7 months since the referendum. And for the first period, Prime Minister Theresa May went around saying, Brexit means Brexit. And nobody understood what on earth that meant. It sounded kind of like parents saying to their kids, bedtime means bedtime, and not saying when the bedtime was. And finally, the Prime Minister came out last week and tried to put some specifics on the table. And the specifics include Britain absolutely does want to have control over its borders, so no more open-ended invitations for EU citizens to come and live and work in Britain. As a corollary of that, Britain will have to leave the single market, and she accepts that because you cannot stay in the EU single market unless you accept freedom of movement. And the other big thing that she's emphasizing is that she really, really cares that the European Court of Justice should no longer have jurisdiction over Britain. And over time, if you're not part of the European Court of Justice, it follows that you can't also be part of the single market because that's the body that adjudicates disputes of a commercial nature that arise within the single market. So that's what Theresa May has put on the table. We still don't know the specifics about what that will mean because she says she wants an alternative, a sort of replacement trade arrangement with the rest of Europe, which after all takes 43% of Britain's exports, so Britain doesn't want to walk away. But what that replacement looks like, nobody has any idea. We know that Theresa May plans to invoke Article 50, triggering the formal start of negotiations by the end of March of this year, and to conclude the whole thing by March of 2019. But we don't know whether there'll be a transition arrangement at the end of that, because probably there won't be time to have negotiated a new replacement deal with European partners. And so whether there's a cliff edge effect where the existing single market membership evaporates and Britain is still waiting for the replacement deal, and in the meantime, it falls into the abyss, nobody knows. If you're running a business in Britain, there's a lot of doubt.
So uncertainty is the word for right now.
Uncertainty is absolutely the word for right now.
Let me draw you out in a couple of the specifics, Sebastian, before we talk about what Prime Minister May and President Trump are going to talk about when they sit down to meet. One question comes from this Supreme Court ruling, British Supreme Court ruling that Prime Minister May has to get the approval of Parliament to actually start the process of withdrawing from the EU through Article 50, but also saying, I think quite importantly, that the national legislatures, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales, don't themselves have to vote. What do we expect will come of the parliamentary process? Is the Parliament, I guess it's both the House of Commons and the House of Lords, have to vote in the affirmative? Do we expect to see any hang-ups there? Is this just a technicality?
I think it's a technicality. I mean, this is the kind of thing where if you were to say in the U.S. political context that all of a sudden something which was going to be an executive decision has to go through the Congress, you'd think, oh my goodness, that could be, you know, weeks and months of delay. Well, in the British context, the governing party, the Prime Minister, has control over the powerful part of Parliament. That's the House of Commons, the lower house. And so Theresa May has a majority there, and she'll just push it through. The opposition right now is peculiarly fragmented. The Labour Party is under the leadership of Jeremy Corbyn, who is on the left of his party and a pretty ineffectual leader. So that makes the odds of resistance within the House of Commons even lower than it normally would be.
And many Labour voters voted to leave the EU.
That's true, exactly. So Jeremy Corbyn wouldn't want to get in the way of this. And everybody's feeling the threat, both the Conservative Party and the Labour Party, all the traditional parties, feel the threat from UKIP, which is has an ability to
appeal. This is the United Kingdom Independence Party.
Yes, that's right, which campaigned from the beginning for the EU. For getting out of the EU. And UKIP has the ability to take votes away both from the Labour Party and from the Conservative Party, so it has both of the establishment parties running scared.
Sebastian, one other background question before we talk about the Trump-May conversation, and that has to do with Prime Minister May's announcement that she intends to invoke Article 50 at the end of March. She has 2 years, as you noted, to work out a deal. Big question in my mind is why start the clock ticking at the end of March when we know that French elections aren't until April or more likely May because it's two rounds. German elections aren't until the fall, and in Germany, and Angela Merkel are going to basically be the big negotiating partner. Why start the clock ticking when there's not really going to be anybody to negotiate with for?
I mean, that's an extremely good question to which there isn't a very great answer. I mean, it does not make sense if you've got a two-year negotiating window to invoke Article 50, which begins the negotiations, and find that, as you say, for the first 6 months, nothing can happen because we're all waiting to get through those two elections in France and Germany. Why did Theresa May nonetheless do it this way? Well, the reason is she felt that she had to go quickly. You know, there was a mandate in the referendum last June to get out of the EU, and she felt she could sort of delay invoking Article 50 for up to 9 months. But anything beyond that would cost political support. Voters would get frustrated that, you know, they'd voted for out, even though actually it was only 52% of the voters who did that. Nonetheless, there was a strong sense in the leadership of the Conservative Party around Theresa May that if they didn't enact and sort of implement this referendum mandate fairly fast, it would cost them politically.
So, Sebastian, along these lines of the clock ticking, May visits Donald Trump in the United States, but it's not clear exactly what kind of agreement they could reach at this stage, given the fact that there's all this uncertainty that you discussed. What are they hoping to achieve in this meeting, which Brexit is supposed to be the top of the agenda?
Well, it's a difficult one to understand, which reflects the general difficulty of understanding Theresa May's posture right now. On the one hand, last week, she gave this speech in which she affirmed that Britain would be leaving the European single market. On the other hand, she showed up in Davos just 2 days later and said, you know, globalizing Britain will be even more outward looking after leaving the EU than before it, and that we believe in trade, which is a strange thing to say when you're also at the same time promising to exit your deepest and most important trading relationship, which is the EU single market. So when it comes to this visit to the United States to meet with President Trump, it's difficult to know whether Theresa May is there primarily to try to get talks started on a potential UK-US free trade deal, which would be part of the kind of maneuvering to get Britain into good trading relationships post-EU exit, or whether she's there sort of more as a spokeswoman for the European and kind of erstwhile allies' perspective, you know, trying to urge the US president to take NATO seriously, to take traditional global trading arrangements in the WTO seriously, not to start a trade war with China. There are all those kind of global commons, traditional UK foreign policy interests, which are also coming out of Theresa May's mouth at the same time as she has this novel agenda of sorting out a post-EU arrangement for Britain.
So meantime, the Trump administration has hit the ground running in terms of its trade initiatives or its trade agenda, shall I say, withdrawing the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership and making trying to make an emphatic point about the U.S. preference for bilateral over multilateral deals, as President-elect Donald Trump was already disdainful of the EU. So is this possible that this meeting, they will sort of both strike a sovereign blow for bilateral deals, perhaps?
Well, that's what it looks like. Any negotiation which feels like a commercial, almost a sort of real estate negotiation where you've got two parties at the table and you can effectively pressure the other side by threatening and so forth, that seems to appeal to President Trump. I mean, he said explicitly that the good thing about a bilateral deal is that if the other side does something you don't like, you send them a letter, you say you've got 30 days to clean it up, and if you don't clean it up, we're gone.
One strike and you're out.
One strike and you're out. And if you're the United States and you're the biggest economy in the world, the other side will always be at a weaker position than you are. On the other hand, in a multilateral forum, whether it's the World Trade Organization or potentially in TTIP, it would have been like that. The U.S. is one voice amongst many. It can't dictate its terms. And that's the kind of binding multilateral rules-based system that does not so much appeal to President Trump.
What is lost, Sebastian, if that kind of multilateral rules-based system is eroded or collapses?
Well, in a way, the whole point of a trade agreement is to establish rules of the game for business which are stable and lasting and which allow you to make an investment in year one, to make widgets in years 2 to 10, and to know in year one that the rules around exporting those widgets are not going to change. And a bilateral deal, the supposed virtue of which is that you can exit it in 30 days, destroys the premise of what makes a trade deal good in the first place. That's point number one. The second thing I'd say is that a lot of the point of a trade deal is to remove customs checks and red tape in trade between countries. But if you've got a kind of cat's cradle of bilateral deals, you have to have rules of origin so that, you know, the nature of the deal, let's say between the UK and the US, allows you to move cars without tariffs, but then the US have a different deal with East Asia, which has a 3% tariff. And this becomes a kind of complicated cat's cradle, and you have to monitor it with checks as to whether the car that's supposedly coming from Britain on a zero tariff wasn't maybe just shipped in from South Korea and then reshipped to the US to get around this set of rules you've set up. So the more that you have these bilateral deals, the less of real liberalization you end up getting.
So the first argument for multilateralism is predictability. The second argument is efficiency.
Correct.
Let me ask just another question, just in terms of the British leaving the European Union, this whole Brexit process. Does the United States have any role in that? Is there anything that Washington can do, that the Trump administration can do to increase British leverage in terms of the benefits and concessions it's trying to get from the EU? Or is Washington simply an outsider who may have a vested interest in how it all turns out, but has no say?
I think there's rather modest U.S. influence here. I mean, it was striking that President Obama tried to have influence over the British voters.
He told them they would go to the end of the queue.
Right. He said that, you know, don't expect to get a free trade deal with the U.S. We're going to put you at the end of the queue, so don't vote to leave that trading arrangement thinking you'll get a spanking new deal with the U.S., because you won't. Now, of course, President Trump has immediately negated what President Obama said. But the point I'm making is that when President Obama said that back last summer, it had zero effect, apparently, on how British voters chose to cast their votes. And in the same way today, maybe there would be an influence at the margin if President Trump were to say to Angela Merkel, assuming she still is the Chancellor of Germany when this negotiation comes to a head, look, we'd really rather you had a good relationship with the UK. And, you know, if you want these three things from the US, you know, one thing we're asking for in return is that you patch things up with Britain. Maybe at the margin that has an impact, and I think it's pretty marginal.
So, Sebastian, in terms of what kind of increase in trade we could witness between the U.S. and Britain, I mean, I believe the U.S. is already, as a country, the second largest trading partner by country with Britain, and it's a major source of inward investment. So what kind of – how much bigger could trade get between these two countries?
You know, one of the things about trade deals right now is that tariffs on goods – manufacturing goods are already pretty low across the board because of the World Trade Organization, which caps what they can be. And the important liberalization that you can get through bilateral deals or regional deals often has to do with the harmonization of things like safety standards, kind of behind the border, so-called protections that are not in the tariff, they are in regulatory harmonization. And those types of things are very hard to get right. There's a lot of enormously detailed negotiating work that goes into that. If you get that right, you can facilitate things like services trade. So you could imagine that, an architecture practice based out of, somewhere in the US could come and do architecture, construct buildings in Britain without having to get a whole separate series of certifications. You could do the same thing in legal services. You could do the same thing in all kinds of media products, perhaps. I think there's some scope there, potentially, if you had a very deep and high-quality deal. But it's not the kind of thing which, you negotiate in a year or two. And that's a long-term thing. And so when Donald Trump said recently, we could do a deal with Britain very quickly, you could probably do a deal with Britain very quickly, but a deal that mattered is going to be full of these behind-the-border details, and that takes time.
Well, can I draw you up on that, Sebastian? Because as you point out, President Trump has talked about a U.S.-Britain trade deal as something that could be done very quickly. I've talked to a number of trade officials, and they said to me that negotiating any deal with Britain is going to be very hard to do until you know what the exit terms are for Britain leaving the European Union. In essence, you can't get married until the other person gets divorced. I mean, how do I make sense of those sort of two competing visions?
Well, I mean, I think the second vision that you're hearing, which is that it's complicated and you've got to wait for Britain's terms of exit from the EU to be clarified, that's the correct one. Because again, it has to do with this rule of origin stuff. If it was the case that Britain was still going to be having, let's say the extreme example, a zero tariff customs union, with the rest of the EU, so that goods from all over the EU were coming into Britain tariff-free, then they could be re-exported, theoretically, from Britain to the US under the terms of a new US-UK deal. And you'd have to think about whether the US was okay with that, and if not, what are the bureaucratic and customs-checking provisions that you would put in place to control that inflow. And so you can't get into those specifics until you know what you're dealing with. And the key thing here is that although the exit of Britain from the EU can probably be done within the deadline of 2 years, so by March of 2019, I think that is plausible. What is less plausible is that the new terms of the successor arrangement could be negotiated that quickly. That's the kind of thing which I think will take more like 4 years or so.
So you're talking there's a difference between a divorce decree and, let's say, the property settlement or the alimony rules and regulations.
That's a good extension of the analogy, yes.
So in that sense, then, for the United States, it could be a long time before you could negotiate an agreement with the United Kingdom, even though leaders on both sides seem to be very excited about this prospect.
Yeah, so you could have the announcement that you're going to start negotiating it. You could have talks set up at a kind of working level, but I don't think you could really push those talks to a conclusion for many years hence.
Now, my sense is that there are a fair number of British leaders who are excited about the prospect of a trade deal of Anglo-Saxon nations, I guess. But would Britain or the United Kingdom really want a trade deal given Mr. Trump's view of bilateral trade deals that you outlined, in essence, because in any bilateral trade deal, the United States has the most clout and can get the biggest concessions?
Right now, the political temperature in Britain is such that the government is sort of desperate. It wants to show that other countries will do deals with us. And so Theresa May is not only going to meet President Trump, she's also going to China to talk to the Chinese about trading relationships. And this is sort of, the desperate attempt to preserve the idea of an open global Britain, even as Britain is deglobalizing by pulling out of the EU. So if the question were put now, would Britain accept a bilateral deal with the US, given that the US would have the upper hand in power terms? I think yes. Given that it's going to take, though, 4, 5, 6 years to conclude such a deal, I think by then the climate of opinion in Britain may have changed. And it's a bit unpredictable as to whether the British would be willing to accept a deal that put them in the weaker position.
Well, I would think that desperation generally doesn't give you the best negotiating leverage.
True.
One other facet that we haven't discussed is actually the UK itself disintegrating. We started out this program with the clip from candidate Trump in Scotland. Scotland, of course, voted heavily to remain and has been making sounds about holding its own independence referendum. How do you see that playing out, Sebastian?
Well, it's true that one of the big sea changes in British politics in the last few years has been the rise of the Scottish National Party. And so if they see a chance to push for that coming out of this whole Brexit process, you know, one shouldn't discount their desire to do that. But I think there are a couple of basic economic points that are going to point in the other direction. And one thing is that it was okay to argue for Scottish independence when there was that referendum in 2014, where independence at one point was ahead and ultimately lost by quite a narrow margin. But that was in the context of Britain remaining in the EU. We were not at that point in a Brexit position. Now, if you imagine Scotland going independent and staying in the EU while England was out of the EU, it implies that there'd have to be a border between Scotland and England with customs checks on it, because on one side you're in the EU, the other side you're out. And that process of imposing checks on the border would be massively disruptive to business, which is just used to ignoring the border and conducting commerce across that border as though it wasn't there. And so I think paradoxically, although politically Brexit provides Scotland with a murky and uncertain mess, which could be exploited to try and trigger a second referendum for Scottish independence, economically and practically, it makes independence less attractive.
Sebastian, if I may, I want to go back to those global commons issues that you raised earlier on, and talk about the broader U.S.-United Kingdom relationship. And I want to get a sense from you, how does Britain, the British government, view the special relationship today? How do they view Mr. Trump and the foreign policy that he is proposing to bring forth? And I'm sure plenty of people in the United Kingdom watch the president's inaugural address. Maybe you could sort of give us sort of a big picture view. Maybe we can talk about some issues like NATO, and the rest.
I think the special relationship has suffered a big decline in popularity in the last 10 years. The high point of the special relationship was when Tony Blair was such an outspoken ally of President George W. Bush during the Iraq War and a spokesman for the moral rightness of that conflict. And that war now in Britain is viewed with even more disdain than it is in the United States. I mean, I'm struck when I'm at a kind of roundtable type discussion in Washington, D.C. If I say that I supported the Iraq War before the fact because I thought there were weapons of mass destruction, but now that I see that there weren't, I think I was wrong. That in Washington, D.C. would be treated as a reasonable position. Okay, you were wrong, but you accept it, you admit it, that's all right. In London, if I say the same thing at the similar type of discussion, they think I'm an idiot, immoral, bad, and I should leave. I mean, the visceral hatred of what was the Iraq War in the kind of political discussion in Britain is much, much more intense. The dislike of Tony Blair because of his support for the United States in that conflict was extremely intense. And we saw this in that famous vote when the UK was going to support the bombing of Syria. And David Cameron, the Prime Minister at the time, was unable to deliver a Commons majority to support the United States in that action.
And that was unusual because essentially that meant members of his own party were voting against him.
Exactly. And that shows how what would have been a classic special relationship litmus test, which Britain would have passed in years before because it would have wanted to demonstrate being shoulder to shoulder with the United States in a matter of global security, it went the other way with the Syria vote. And I think we're still in that kind of zone where there is a lot of skepticism about American foreign policy. There's a lot of memories of the Iraq War. There's a lot of distaste on a humanitarian level with what's happened in Syria. But at the same time, there was no appetite to go in and help the US prevent some of this fallout. So I think Britain, and then on top of all that, of course, Britain is withdrawing into itself because this debate over Brexit is dominating politics and leaving no oxygen for anything else. So I think, you know, the special relationship has taken a lot of knocks, and Donald Trump is not personally popular in the least.
Although Trump actually has signaled more hands-off role for the U.S. in places like the Middle East, and it was critical, particularly of Iraq, regardless of his initial position on it. He certainly repeatedly criticized that campaign. He's used it as an example of the U.S. intelligence community's failings as well. So there might be some room there for warming, perhaps.
Well, perhaps, although I think this is driven, you know, by something other than just sort of specific policy positions on Iraq. I think the fact that Donald Trump says he opposed the Iraq war in the eyes of most British observers, you know, doesn't exonerate him from the fact that his position on global warming is, you know, seen as wrong, that his disdain for NATO is dangerous, that his willingness to pick trade fights with China is unnerving, and so forth. I think, you know, there are so many points of skepticism with respect to President Trump in Britain that it trumps the question of Iraq.
So it's safe to say that President Trump isn't going to be able to rely on Prime Minister May the same way George W. Bush did on Tony Blair. Do you have any sense, Sebastian, whether Prime Minister May has a message for President Trump on an issue like NATO? Because I would imagine for Britain, if it does in fact leave the EU, it seems inevitable, NATO will become all the more important. Meanwhile, President Trump has been raising a lot of questions about the future of NATO.
Yes, that's right. And I think Theresa May has made it clear that she will raise the question of NATO, and she will emphasize that it's important and that she would like to, President Trump to take it seriously. I think you're right, Jim, that one of the oddities as Britain leaves the EU is that it engenders this anxious desire to demonstrate commitment to multilateral fora of other sorts. It's worth remembering that Theresa May personally, before the referendum vote, was a narrow supporter of remaining in the EU. So now she's leading the government that's taking us out of the EU, and she wants to compensate for that by being pro-NATO.
Sebastian, another topic that looms large in any discussion of U.S. and its allies is Russia. And it played a major role in discussions on the campaign trail. There are anticipations about how the U.S. relationship with Russia could change in the days and weeks ahead. Are they likely to get into that in any detail, you think, in the May-Trump discussion?
I think it might come up. But I think that the distinction between President Trump's sort of willingness to be sympathetic to Vladimir Putin and the European hostility to Putin, that would come up as a clearer contrast if this were a meeting with Angela Merkel. I mean, Angela Merkel really is the leader of the let's be tough on Putin faction. Britain has enormous amounts of Russian investment. London has lots and lots of oligarch money. Famously, the Chelsea Football Club is owned by a Russian oligarch. And so there's always been this slight ambivalence in the British position versus Russia, that the City of London and a lot of legal practices are raking in enormous fees by servicing Russian money, even as Putin himself is seen as a geopolitical problem. And there was a famous moment when going into a briefing in Whitehall, a British diplomat was stupidly holding his briefing documents outside his briefcase, and with a telephoto lens, a news journalist kind of zoomed in on it and photographed it. And all the talking points were, exactly how much money London was going to lose if there were sanctions on Russia. So I think Theresa May will reflect that ambivalence and probably be less determined to insist on a hard line with Putin than, say, Merkel would have been.
Let's talk about the other great power, Sebastian, China. You've alluded already to the fact that Prime Minister May is hoping to increase Britain's commercial relations with China. Makes sense. One of the world's largest markets, certainly the world's most populous countries. But obviously, Mr. Trump has signaled that China is a country in his sights. He's tired of what he calls China raping the American economy. His Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, indicated the United States is going to stop China's island building in the South China Sea. How do you think that conversation might go between Prime Minister May and President Trump, particularly given that Great Britain, while it is one of the few NATO countries to be spending at least 2% of its budget on defense, has a considerably diminished capacity, particularly naval capacity, and may not be able to help the United States that much far away in East Asia.
Yeah, I mean, the British attitude towards China recently has gone as follows. In the David Cameron government, the finance minister, George Osborne, made a real thing about going to Beijing a lot and talking up the commercial relationship, trying to get the Chinese to use London as the place in which it would issue renminbi-denominated bonds. The Chinese were invited into a major state-backed nuclear deal, which was going to be a nuclear development in Britain for nuclear power that would then give China a sort of track record in involvement in Western civilian nuclear power projects, which would then enable China to go sell nuclear power elsewhere in Europe. So there was a very cozy commercial relationship. And when Theresa May took over, I think almost as petty as this, her personal dislike and rivalry with George Osborne, the finance minister, led her to kind of call into question his pro-China policy. And so there was this review put in place of the nuclear agreement with China. And that review ended up in green lighting the cooperation with China. But just the mere fact that it was called into question annoyed the Chinese. And I think what you're seeing now with Brexit going ahead is that Theresa May realizes that she needs sort of the China card again to balance the fact that Britain is withdrawing from its deep trade interaction with Europe and it needs alternatives. And so she wants to play up the China angle, go back to the George Osborne policy of being pro-China. And with the President of the United States being tough on China, in a way, makes that even more attractive, because right when the Chinese feel they need allies, Theresa May can hold herself out as a sort of bridging person between China and the U.S. in a way that I imagine that Xi Jinping would welcome.
So Washington and the Trump presidency should not assume axiomatic British support for what it wishes to do over the next 4 years.
I agree.
I would say the other thing I'm hearing is talking about a great deal of transactional relationships, whether it's the May government or potentially the Trump government. And here are two countries that have usually stood very tall together in terms of exporting values, so-called international human rights values, what have you. They've worked together closely in the UN Security Council as fellow veto-wielding members. We could be entering, potentially, Sebastian, a new era where you're not necessarily hearing these two countries sort of in the vanguard of human rights, but maybe a different type of relationship.
Bob, you sound like you're channeling, was it Lord Palmerston who said no permanent friends, only permanent interests?
I think what we're seeing in both Britain and the United States is a new kind of politics that essentially says the forgotten man, who doesn't frankly care that much about global human rights, but is struggling to get by in a blue-collar part of this country, has been forgotten. You know, the manufacturing jobs have been shipped abroad and so forth. The new value, which unites both the kind of Trump view of the world and the Theresa May view of the world, is we got to look after these domestic struggling families. That means doing commercial deals. That means being transactional in international relations because, you know, your heart is with these people you feel have lost out.
Well, on that note, we'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. Sebastian, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
Be sure to subscribe to the President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Please note that opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazzo with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock and recording engineers Glenn Goldman and John Fletcher. Special thanks to Audrey Bowler and Aliyah Medvedkova. This is Jim Lindsay.
And this is Robert McMahon. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon on the President's Inbox.